Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download a podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I am Harry Brady. And yes, you wait around for ages and then two podcasts come along. Just two or three days ago, we uploaded the Celtic Strikers for the Champions League 11 podcast, number 200D, with Hullboy and myself talking about Larson and the Strikers. And tomorrow we have the AGM, so we have podcast number 201, which is about the 2013 Celtic AGM. There'll be another podcast shortly after talking about Amsterdam and the disgrace there. And then we will have another podcast talking about a review of the AGM. So this is your perfect guide to the Celtic AGM and the resolutions of 2013. So I am once again joined by Hullboy. How are you doing, Hullboy?
I'm fine, thanks, Harry. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. It seems like only 2 days ago that I spoke to you.
That's because it was only 2 days ago.
So we have done our Champions League team and people are rattling in the votes on players on that. But the reason for doing this, hopefully I'll get it out tonight, and tonight being Thursday, the 14th. Tomorrow we have the Celtic AGM.
Celtic AGM, yep. Kind of the annual jamboree.
It should be a bit more interesting than the last few AGMs that that we've been to. Have you been to many AGMs of Celtic?
I've been to one in the dim past, but not been to any of the recent ones, and don't really need to now because we get all the corporate videos and we get people like yourself and others tweeting every single word from the AGM.
This AGM may be interesting because I think Celtic may do an official one. I'll be doing one. Celtic Trust will do one. Mine and the Celtic Trust are always very different. I would chuck in that I believe that's because they editorialise and I don't. And Eddie Pearson will be doing one.
He's doing one as well, right? Okay, so we've got it is going to be a GM overload then.
Yeah, so we can compare. Just as one of the difficulties, one of the reasons why I try not to editorialise, but chucking in the odd thing of Neil Lennon staring in the space, it's actually quite difficult when you get to the Q&A section to do anything other than try and concentrate on what's just been said.
Yeah.
Summarising 140 characters, while you're trying to do that, listen to the answer of the person and then get that back out. It actually does, it's difficult to do anything other than just report what's been said. And you will get differences because you're trying to paraphrase what somebody said in 140 characters.
Absolutely. And not you can't convey the language.
Correct. For those who've not been, I'll give you, and you're the more technical guy than I, Hullboy. I'll give people a summary of how democracy in a PLC works. The guy who spent the most money wins.
He does.
So, resolutions 1 through 7, which I'll go through in a moment. Resolution 6 I find interesting, and I'll go through them all. Resolution 1 through 7 will be discussed briefly. There will then be a show of hands in the room. There'll be about 200 to 500 people in the room. About 4 people will vote against every one of the board's resolutions, maximum, in general. And then the votes will be counted, and the votes will be 99.98% in favour and about 0.02% against. So that's pretty much how it will go until the last two resolutions, or the last three resolutions, I think it is, where you'll then have debate, more hands will be against the board, and the board will still win. Does that about sum it up?
That just about sums it up, yep. That's very good, and obviously the phrase absent landlord will arise as well.
However, you do you'll be able to, although the absent landlord has the most votes in his pocket, it is not the done thing for the absent landlord to dismiss the view of the majority of the number of people, if not the majority of votes. It's not a great thing for a PLC to have 28,000 shareholders, of which 27,000 own 5%, or whatever the percentage is, and to ignore the 20-odd thousand who vote one. Which is why it's important, even if you're not going along, to try and vote.
Exactly, yeah. And I think, you know, we are where we are, and we're kind of saying some of these things slightly tongue-in-cheek, and obviously there is a view that Dermot Desmond holds far too much sway over, you know, what is not just a public company, but a company that at times kind of proudly boasts of its massive shareholding across the support, you know. But I think that in reality has just ended up being a bit of a soundbite, really. I think the other thing to say as well is, apart from the kind of normal business conduct resolutions, which, as you say, are kind of the first 8 and 9 resolutions, at least what I don't always agree with the resolutions that come forward via the Celtic Trust or anybody else, but I actually think that it's healthy and it's creditable that we've got sections of the support who continue to kind of raise issues and challenge through that process.
Yeah, and despite my flippant tongue-in-cheek, everybody votes against and then the board win.
Yeah.
It's not palatable for the board to have the mood of the room against them.
Mm.
I mean, no matter what you think of John Reid, I thought he was the consummate politician, or he managed that environment very well.
Yep, absolutely.
And usually had people laughing at his jokes, and rallied the troops in a bit of a tub-thumping way whenever necessary. And the fact that even during the Tony Mowbray period, when things were not going well, the board got a relatively easy ride at an AGM.
Yeah. Well, I think John Reid as well is whatever you think of his politics or his style or some of the decisions he's made in political life, he actually used the vehicle of the AGM to raise some very, very important issues about the way in which Celtic were being treated in Scottish football and the way in which Scottish football was being run. So, it'll be interesting again tomorrow to see how Celtic used the AGM as a vehicle for raising any issues. I know, obviously, the support are raising issues through their resolutions, or sections of the support. It'll be interesting to see how Celtic respond. I mean, obviously, we have a far less politically, with a small p, motivated chairman now, in my view.
And I do find that the point you made about John Reid and his criticism of the governance of the SFA particularly relevant to resolution number 12.
Absolutely.
But if we quickly rattle through the resolutions, the first one is...
You should just confirm as well. I mean, anybody who wants to go along, it starts at 10:30.
Yep.
And you can speculate that as each resolution gets knocked down as to what hole Dermot Desmond will be putting out on.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Has anybody... Yes, if Dermot, if you're listening, the AGM is at a place called Celtic Park. For your sat-nav, the postcode is G43RE. For greater reference, Dermot is in a place called Scotland. It's probably equidistant. It's closer towards Turnberry than St Andrews. You'll find it somewhere around there. So, resolution number one is the approval of the company accounts. That would pass straightforwardly. Eric Reilly, the directors have to retire. So Eric Reilly has to retire and then will be reappointed as a director. Peter Lawwell is up for renewal.
Yes.
Dermot Desmond's up for renewal.
I know that. We get the full set this year.
Yeah. Dermot Desmond always gets more hands in the room against his renewal than the other directors.
Yep.
But he doesn't care because he's not there.
No.
Tom Allison is also one, and Tom Allison's a gentleman that I will come back to in relation to resolution number 11.
Mm.
Another interesting one is number 6.
BDO.
BDO, as auditors of the company. I wonder if anybody will raise a query about a conflict of interest in their relationship with a recently liquidated football club who used to be a competitor.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think somebody will.
And they will do.
Yeah. Resolution 7 partly relates to resolutions 5 and 11 to me. Authorise the directors to determine the remuneration of, well, it's the remuneration of the auditor, so that's not nothing. Resolution 8 is, what is it? Is it issuance of new shares?
Rights issues, yeah.
Yeah. There's always one. We see one of those on a regular basis.
It's not important, Harry.
No.
It's not important. Move on.
Yes, that's very much the theme that Ian Blackie will be teaching. The amount of $2,346,788. It's not important, gentlemen. Look over there. There's a squirrel.
Number 9's not important because it relates to number 8.
Pretty much the first 9 are not important.
And No.
No, what I mean is, the way that the first 9 are not important enough for us to bother about.
2, 3, 4, and 5 are important.
No, that's yes, 2, 3, 4. Don't bother about them, plebs, don't bother about them. And then the next 3, you shouldn't be interested in them.
Exactly, yeah.
Is that the general theme of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, but the ones that are important are 10, 11, and 12.
Okay. So, I will let you take us through 10, 11, and 12.
Okay. It is quite interesting, really, because I think a number of people will be aware of resolutions 11 and 12, which 11 relates to the living wage, and 12 relates to quite a lengthy resolution, really, around an inquiry into the SFA and license compliance requirements. But I suppose it's worth just speaking about Resolution 10, because this is kind of like historically something that's come from the Celtic Trust, in that they've always pushed for supporter representation on the board.
Yep.
And really where the club has got to is that I think it's mandatory under UEFA regulations that a club has to have a supporter liaison officer, and obviously Celtic have gone ahead and appointed John Paul Taylor, and I think, you know, the feedback that you get is that he's doing a very, very good job.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what Celtic Trust are saying is that they would still like to see, how could I describe it, a kind of a cementing, if you like, between supporter representation and officials of the club. Mm-hmm. So that there is a greater two-way communication process. So I think, well, the actual resolution says this AGM requests that the board organises a working party on corporate governance with representatives of the board and supporters organisations and with the supporters liaison officer which will report to the 2014 AGM. This report will include recommendations to improve and formalise a two-way communication structure between the supporters and the board, and to consider in detail how the role of the supporters' liaison officer will work in practice. So, you know, I think that's an interesting move by the Celtic Trust to kind of keep that to keep that pressure on, if you like.
Yep.
You know, and I mean, reading between the lines politically, that they obviously recognise that John Paul's doing a good job, but they still want that they still want that greater influence, if you like, and greater say. Not the Celtic Trust themselves, but the Celtic Trust in terms of supporters.
Yeah. I mean, invariably shareholder requisition resolutions are not supported by the board. There may have been one. I can't think of any AGM that I've been to where the shareholder resolutions have been supported by the board.
Yeah.
In some ways, I think this is one where it wouldn't be too difficult for the board to work with it. They already have the John Paul Taylor in the role.
Yeah.
They can provide more detail at the AGM, or they may say, well, we actually have a very concrete two-way communication structure in place.
Yeah.
They can articulate that. But it would then be easy to say, as part of that, and to emphasise we're doing it, we're quite happy to set up a working party to ensure that this is the first year that we've got this family liaison in place, so we're quite happy to set up a working party to finesse that dialogue, and we'll have that working party presented the next AGM.
Yeah, and do you know what? That's exactly what they've not said.
I know. But for me, that would be a neat... That's, you know, I look at all these things and I look at it from my own perspective of business and negotiations, and I think, right, OK, how's the best way to keep people on side but knock it out of the park?
Yeah.
And the best way to keep people on side is to actually turn around and accept at least one of these three resolutions.
Yeah.
So you accept the one that's easiest?
Yeah. But I mean, their formal response really is to say, well, we know what we do at the moment, this is what we do at the moment, and we'd like to carry on with that, and so therefore we don't support that resolution, which it just seems, I don't know, it's difficult because, I mean, obviously there are always gripes and groans, etc., but those are very often kind of very quickly dealt with now by John Paul Taylor.
Yeah.
On a proactive basis. But
I mean, it really, it's not a cost. It's not a particularly costly resolution.
No.
It's not. It wouldn't get in the way of Celtic doing their everyday business.
No.
The point being, they could do it. I don't mean this in the way that it's going to come across. They could do it in a superficial manner.
Mm-hmm.
Be seen to accept the resolution. I do wonder whether it's got to a point where if the Celtic Supporters Trust said, we would propose that Celtic play their home games on a day with the Y, with a Y in the name in the day of the week, that the board would say, no, we disagree.
Yeah.
You know, I do wonder if it's got to the point where it doesn't matter what the Trust recommend, and you know my thoughts on the Trust and things.
I think that's right. I think the other way to summarise it is that Peter Lawwell, the Celtic board, take the view that Celtic business is to be managed by Celtic employees, and they don't wish for Celtic's business to be managed by unpaid supporters.
Yep.
And it kind of comes down to that, and you know they're never quite going to come out and say it in those kind of categorical terms, but that's ultimately what all this is about.
Yeah, and they're going to turn around and say, John Paul Taylor meets with this group, that group, the other group. It's diarised. It's in. It happens all the time. John Paul Taylor speaks at the board meetings. He does a report. His report is included within the report of XYZ person at every board meeting. What more do you want us to do? And that's why I say it's the resolution that could be most superficially passed.
Yeah.
If you're the board and you can't be bothered with it.
Yeah.
But they won't. The next, what I would suggest is a slight, their rejection is slightly more controversial.
Well, let's just move into this one. Resolution 11 is really a call for Celtic to back the Scottish Living Wage objectives and to declare itself as a Scottish Living Wage employer. And I think the resolution that's been put forward is, I think it's an admirable resolution. I think it's well thought through. I think it's well written, and I think there's some good, undoubted historical context as to the reasons why Celtic should adopt that resolution and become a Scottish Living Wage employer. And I think, you know, in terms of business that we've seen at AGMs in recent years, there's a lot of people who actually, you know, kind of more or less sit on the fence on a number of these resolutions come forward. But I think in this particular case, Celtic have actually recommended that shareholders vote against this. And from my perspective, the response that they've given, which is a very wordy way of saying, no, we don't agree with this, you know, by talking about the way in which people are remunerated at Celtic, I think there are two things, really. I think if I could put it in blunt terms, Celtic should have done the right thing on this and adopted this resolution. The cost to the club, the PLC, would have been relatively small. Mm-hmm. In an industry where people are, in certain roles, are vastly overpaid for what they do, vastly overpaid.
Yeah.
And I think there's an opportunity, you and I have had discussions about the living wage off these podcasts, there are employers up and down the UK, England, Scotland, who now want to see themselves as exemplar employers, who are committing themselves to being a living wage employer. And Celtic should really be taking the lead on this. Be the first football club to actually adopt this stance, and that would send out a great signal. I was talking to somebody at the recent Celtic Graves Society commemoration for the club founders, and he said, you know, somewhere down the line, Celtic will probably adopt being a living wage employer. But that will be well after possibly lots of other football clubs and lots of other employers. And that won't look too good for us. So we should be taking the lead on this now. And I think, you know, I don't get overly critical of the board, but on this particular issue, they're plain wrong and they should have adopted this.
Well, I mentioned Resolution 3 and Resolution 5, in my mind, have an input in Resolution 11.
Yep.
Resolution 3 is the re-election of Peter Lawwell.
Yep.
Peter Lawwell, salary is...
£999,000 if you include bonuses and in-kind benefits.
I think his basic salary is £750, somewhere in there.
No, it's not as high as that. Is it not? £507,000,
I think. Right. Well, and it then becomes where you put a comparator. Obviously, if you use football as a comparable, part of the problem is you've just identified football as an overpaid, at the top end, football's an overpaid sport, grossly overpaid sport. If you look at the average salary, basic salary of a FTSE 250, CEO, whose turnovers will all, the FTSE 250 turnover is all well in excess of Celtic's turnover. The average base salary is 450. Of a FTSE 250 CEO. There is a strong argument that Peter, you know, if Celtic's point is that they can't afford it, there's a very strong argument that Peter Lawwell's overpaid. If you want to save some money, take it off the CEO's salary. However, the CEO's salary is set by Tom Allison. Tom Allison has a very close relationship with Peter Lawwell. Tom Allison's getting reappointed. I would actually argue if somebody's got an issue with this, the first time to raise it is to talk about Tom Allison's reappointment. And some of the direction of this. I know Tom Allison's the head of the Remuneration Committee, and it's principally about the director's remuneration as a non-exec director in his position. I think we have to look at the disparity between our executive pay and the bottom pay in the company. And when we've got a CEO that's getting paid well above the norm for CEOs with a turnover, a Celtic's turnover, we have to consider is that is rejecting this resolution where we have our executive on the salaries there, is that in line with much of the culture that we generally seem to want about our club?
I think you've nailed it there. That's the thing for me. There's such a disparity between the pay at that lower end with the high earners, you know. And as I say, in an industry, in a club where the cost of that to bring people up to the living wage is it's negligible, you know, in terms of football salaries, and as you point out, non-footballing executive pay. I think somebody said, or Celtic themselves have said, that the cost of this would be about £120,000 a year. Well, on a business that's now turning over 75 million, and even if you discounted Champions League income, there's really no excuse for not adopting this. And we can speculate why, you know, maybe it has been rejected, and it may not necessarily have things to do with Celtic.
You and I suspect it doesn't.
You've got, don't get me wrong, we've got a very capable and able board, but those non-executive directors have got roles and responsibilities and businesses elsewhere, and you just wonder whether they've taken a collective view to resist Celtic adopting a living wage in order to avoid any pressure that may come on their own businesses to adopt such a stance. You know, I mean, I'm speculating there. I've got no knowledge of that, but you could almost see that way of thinking, really. You know, and in terms of Celtic business, there's no reason why those non-executive directors should be voting against it, and furthermore, recommending that the shareholders vote against it.
I
think, just to say, Harry, I think perhaps tomorrow that will be where the AGM does wake up, and there will be some, you know, vociferous comments made against this, because, you know, let's look at the realities of what's been happening at the club over the last, certainly 12 months, and you can go back a little bit further. Celtic have really been championing some of their roots, and Celtic support have been championing the roots of the club in a time of kind of economic hardship, austerity. You know, we're supporting food banks, we're doing things that are associated with Celtic's charitable roots, trying to alleviate poverty by various ways and means amongst groups within the community. And for Celtic to have, you know, they're looking a kind of gift horse in the mouth in that respect, in that they could be saying to be doing something right on their own doorstep with their own employees.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the club's response. The club's response to me reads along the lines of, we pay the market rate, and we have a diverse business, so we have various comparable market rates. So our football staff get paid market rates for football, and our kiosk staff get paid market rates for kiosk, and it's just tough luck for them that's minimum wage.
But if you pay that market rate, what you're doing is, inadvertently, because of the way the system works, you are actually putting a greater burden on the taxpayer. Whereas if you pay that living wage, then that acts as a relief on the tax burden through working tax credits and things like that. And that's what a lot of employers have actually recognised, and why they do it. And what they're saying in other industries, they're saying, well, actually, our employees feel a lot more valued, and it gives them it gives them more of a sense of financial security.
Yeah, I mean,
there's no reason why Celtic couldn't do that. You
know,
if you've got catering staff or ticket staff or whatever, and you're actually saying, well, actually, we value you and we're going to pay you at this higher rate, what's the problem there?
And one of the things I looked at that and I thought, is the issue for Celtic that they contract out so much of the low-paid work at Celtic Park? So are Celtic looking at this thinking, but the difficulty we've then got is, how do we get our contractors to pay the living wage? That's the only thing I could think of was Celtic's thought process on this.
But that isn't what's being asked.
Oh, I know, and it's not being asked. It's not saying anybody who is employed or works at Celtic Park.
Yep.
It's asking for employees of Celtic.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's why I'm saying the cost against, relative to other employee remuneration, and that's players, manager, directors, there's absolutely no reason for this to be resisted by the board, and I think it's poor.
As someone who employs people, granted I'm not employing the same number of people as Celtic, I don't understand why you wouldn't want to pay your employees the maximum you could afford.
Exactly.
These are human beings you work with on a daily basis.
Exactly.
You want to be able to look them in the eye, and you want that person, you know. It's not a popularity contest, but I quite like the idea that someone who I am in charge of their remuneration thinks that I'm a nice guy. Because I'm not taking the piss.
Yeah. Well, it just helps promote the club. That, you know, if you want to look at it as a business, it helps promote the business. Those people are actually going to say, hey, do you know what? I get a little bit more in my pay packet, and that's great. I work for a good employer.
And it all gets back to, for me, what was so great about the events around the Barcelona game was not just that we beat Barcelona. It was about everything about those two or three days just illustrated why we are not Manchester City, Chelsea and all these other clubs where money comes in, gets spent in the team, and then people go and move on and everything's different.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what? Do you know what one of the sponsorship deals that got the biggest media time across Sky Sports a couple of seasons ago was when Aston Villa decided that they would wear a local charity's logo on their jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm sure Aston Villa did it for altruistic reasons. They did it for the right reasons. But they got some very, very good publicity for themselves and also for the charity in question. And in this particular instance, Celtic would get that. They would get a similar amount of media coverage. You know, and Peter Lowell likes being in the media from time to time. And he could tell a great story about how Celtic, as a football club, are doing something for their low-paid workers, and not just the high earners who we hear about all the time in terms of pay packets.
Yeah. And something that we discussed before we came on this podcast as well, that again, if you're looking at it from a pragmatic perspective, where as a board you're sitting there and you're saying, well, the numbers just don't stack up for me on this. But you appreciate where the bad PR is going to come from it.
Mm-hmm.
There's also something not mentioned in this, but I'm sure people will raise it, and that's zero-hour contract workers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if it was me and I didn't want to exceed to the 7.45 an hour, what I would be looking at is what quid pro quo could I chuck into the mix to minimise my criticism?
Mm-hmm.
And I would look at saying, look, we're not going to go to this level, but what we will do is we will end the practice of zero-hour contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they'll do that.
No.
And both of those do not fit with the culture of our club.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we know where we stand on that, and I think the other thing is as well is that you know, there's a wide spectrum of views across the Celtic support, but it seems on this particular issue and this particular resolution that those wide aspects are all appear to be speaking as one voice. I'm sure that there may well be supporters who don't support it, but I've not spoken to anybody who thinks this is a resolution that should be voted down.
I mean, even if you went as high as it was £250,000 it was going to cost us, I think if you said to most fans, we can do, if we adopt the minimum wage, we will have one less bottom tier player on £250,000 a year. I think most fans would say, well, the ethos of this club is to not just be a football club.
Yeah.
And I would rather do without one £250,000 player.
Yep.
And have everybody on the right salary.
Yep. Well, it really is that simple. It's baffling at one level as to why it's been knocked back. You know, I mean, various resolutions over the years that I've seen that, you know, in principle there's some good in what's been proposed, but you can actually see the counter view as to why that would be opposed. I mean, I recall Celtic actually rejecting dividend reinvestment at one time, and I could actually see why, because at the time the actual proposal that was being put forward was actually flawed, and it would have meant that Celtic weren't actually going to get the reinvestment.
Yeah.
But eventually something was worked through on this, and that's the other thing that's disappointing for me here is that there's nothing being offered in terms of, well, okay, we hear what you're saying. Let's have a look at this and see how we can work this through. You know, over time, it's an unequivocal no, really.
Yeah, and I think, whilst I know someone who used to be company secretary at West Ham, and they literally had a string of stewards linked arm in arm across between the board and the people at the AGM. I don't think I'd be very surprised if I ever get to a Celtic AGM that's like that. But I think this could be one of the more critical AGMs of the board when we get to that resolution.
Yeah, which we'll see.
We will see. So we'll move on to the next resolution, which is the longest resolution, resolution number 12, which is, dear Celtic, they're all cheats, aren't they?
And the Celtic response is yes.
Actually, to be fair in this one, and I'll let you go over it in more detail, I have some sympathy with the board because I know I have a pretty good idea that they're going to have to turn and say, yes, we know this is cheating. Mm-hmm. But technically it's not. And it's a no-win. I think they will agree with the mood of the room, and that will create all the newspaper headlines on Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. So, since it is the longest resolution, I'll let you take everyone through the gist of it.
Yeah, well, actually, it's not the resolution itself isn't that long, but essentially, what the resolution is calling for, it's citing that a number of rules that are the responsibility of being maintained by the Scottish FA. Almost on a delegated basis from UEFA, that there appears to have been a breach of those rules, and the resolution is actually asking for UEFA to actually step in and review and investigate the Scottish FA's implementation of specifically. UEFA licence compliance requirements, and the background to that is, for those who don't know, and it's something that quite a number of supporters, myself included, raised at the time, which was 2011, that technically, because there was an outstanding tax bill to Rangers at a certain date, that under UEFA's regulations, it meant that they shouldn't have been awarded a licence to play European football the following season, which was 2011-12. That licence was granted, and Rangers effectively took their place in the Champions League qualifiers. And the view is, although it's not stated explicitly in any resolution, that Celtic would have effectively taken the place of Rangers and other clubs in the pecking order would have stepped into Celtic's shoes. So I think it may have been, was it Motherwell who effectively would have taken a Europa Cup place instead of Celtic. So that's the kind of gist of the resolution. Where the resolution gets complicated is that I think the wording of quite a bit of supplementary information to the resolution then starts to talk about the way in which the Scottish FA handled the inclusion of Sevco as a new club into the Scottish Football League and the way in which they were given a membership licence. And I think my own view is that because of the wordiness of that resolution, it creates kind of a lot of grey area. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, I think this is an interesting one, and Celtic again have rejected the resolution. But I think what has been a surprise in terms of Celtic's formal response in rejecting or recommending that people vote against the resolution is that Celtic themselves state that they approached the SFA.
Yep.
On the UEFA licensing process at the time, and that they were given assurances that compliance was fully met. Now, one wonders whether there's some kind of political kind of response in that. In that, essentially, what they're saying is, well, we as a member club raised the issue, the Scottish FA came back to us and assured us that everything was okay. So,
to put it in my simple White Sox salesman language, the SFA needed to know by the 31st of March.
Yeah.
They knew on the 1st of April, but that was too late.
And you're hitting on a point which I have raised on a number of occasions in conversations with people, and where I think people tend to overcomplicate the issue of UEFA club licensing. My view is, having looked at everything at the time, I kind of smelt it when I saw that the Rangers accounts didn't come out until the 1st of April, when there was a deadline of the 31st of March, and I knew that they needed to have those accounts out by the 31st of March to be UEFA compliant. And we now know the reason that they didn't was that those accounts had to include the fact that they had an outstanding tax bill, and at that time, that tax bill, which is the small tax case, that tax bill was not disputed. It was recognised by the then Rangers board that they owed that money and that they needed to pay it. And my slight conspiracy theory is that on the 1st of April, when those accounts were published, Alistair Johnston, who was the chairman at the time, I think they created a smokescreen by talking about the big tax case. And the whole media then focused and allowed itself to focus on the big tax case and what the implications of that might mean for Rangers, which obviously we know what happened. But it was a smokescreen to avoid anybody talking about and finding the fact that by their own admission they had an outstanding tax liability, which meant that they were in breach of UEFA licensing.
Now, the thing for me is, the gist of it is, and again, putting in my simple White Sox salesman language, we now know... Well, sorry, I'll need to rephrase that for legal reasons. If certain documents on Twitter are correct, it is alleged that the SFA were aware that Rangers would not fulfil their obligations by the 31st of March in February. It is alleged from those documentations, which we can't prove their accuracy or not, but they appear to be a letter from the SFA saying... You can't fulfil. This isn't right. Can you fix it by the 31st of March?
Yeah, and I think I you're absolutely spot on. And I think the fix that they came up with was delay the publication of your accounts by one day to the 1st of April 2011, and then technically it falls outside of our jurisdiction, because it's for UEFA to consider any further financial information between the 31st of March and the 30th of June. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, Stuart Regan, when he was interviewed on Sportsound, actually more or less confirmed that that was the case. But he didn't say it in those terms.
Because he wasn't asked a simple question.
No, because he just said if anything that fell after the 31st of March fell out of our jurisdiction in terms of making a decision about a licence. So over to you, UEFA. But what he failed to mention was whether a discussion took place prior to the 31st of March between the Scottish FA and that club, in terms of saying, how are we going to get around this?
And the thing that gets me about it is, If the documentation on Twitter in the past week and a half is correct, and in February the SFA wrote to the Rangers of the time and said, you're not going to fulfil your obligations to be able to get a licence, and Rangers didn't get back to them, so only two things can have happened. Either Rangers got back to them and lied, and then on the 1st of April the SFA knew they'd been lied to.
Yep.
Or Rangers didn't get back to them.
Exactly, and I think also as well, I mean, there's so much information that is being leaked, and you know, technically we should err on the side of, as you say, as to whether those documents are actually accurate and legitimate. But what we actually see is something happening in the 2012 process in terms of an exchange of correspondence that suggests that they had quote learned unquote from what happened in 2011, and they knew that somebody else, and that possibly could have been Celtic, would have been onto the Scottish FA in 2012 about possible breach.
And, you know, to use an extreme example, you're formally charged with an offence in Scotland. You need to go to trial within 110 days, I think it is, if my 20-year-old legal training mind is correct. It's a bit like on the 111th day, shouting from the rooftops, walking into a police station and saying, oh, you've missed the boat. I did kill that guy, but you've not taken me to trial yet, and getting away with it.
Mm. Yeah.
If the SFA wanted to turn around and say, well, nothing to do with us. Now, Brogan, whose name I can never remember, he then said that he embellished the Celtic response and said, which I've not seen anywhere else, I've only seen him say that Celtic approached the SFA and were unhappy with the SFA response and wrote to UEFA. And UEFA more or less came back and said, well, it's up to the SFA.
Yeah. And I think that's possibly where this has all got to, you know, and it shows the ineptitude of the Scottish FA, but we should also recognise that there's an ineptitude in UEFA, and there's also an abdication of responsibility, because basically UEFA's premise is, well, actually, all of this resides with the parent football association, and we don't really want to get involved with anything that goes on between a member club and their football association. But if your own rules say, well, actually, it's the responsibility of the football association and their member clubs to sort that out up to date X, and then from date Y onwards, it's our responsibility, then, you know, you can't do that kind of over to you approach, which if that, again, if that response is correct, then you know, UEFA are in breach of their own responsibility.
Yeah, I'm going to ask they may sound like a stupid question, but it's just to make sure that I'm not getting the wrong end of the stick here. By the 31st of March, clubs must prove to their governing football authority that they do not have a problem with taxation in their own country.
Well, it's simple than that. It's that they don't have an outstanding tax liability.
Yeah. So, by the 31st of March, I don't have an outstanding tax liability. That football authority can then say, OK, you're clear to play in next season's European competitions. Correct?
Yeah.
Okay. I can't comprehend how, when it then comes out the day after, so it's prior to the team starting the European competition, I can't work out why prior to the day after, if you then subsequently find out that the team wasn't breached the day before, i.e. the day of the deadline, that the SFA can't say, oh, but it's too late now. No, it's not like you had to know by the 31st of March because everybody was playing on the 1st of April and the game had been played.
Yep.
And as we saw with our debacle with the Swiss team, whose name escapes me just now,
Basel.
Sion. Sion. I remember sending a text to a friend when, as they took to the field, saying, regardless, we are going through to the next round because they are blatantly in breach of rules by playing the players they're playing.
Absolutely.
But the game still went ahead, and retrospectively, after, you know, you were in breach at the time, so we're going ahead with this situation that you lost the game 3-0. I can't comprehend why on the 1st of April, oh, well, we didn't know yesterday, so it's too late.
Exactly.
However, I do appreciate Celtic's no win in this.
There is a little bit of no win, and again, I think there are, you know, obviously within the support, there's quite a lot of vocal people who are saying, you know, Celtic should really back this and put maximum pressure on UEFA to investigate the Scottish FA, and we must take a stance, and this will kind of blow the lid on all the corruption. I don't know. It's a difficult one in some senses, in that one of the good things that Celtic have done over the last 2 years is to make sure, despite a lot of people wanting them to, is to make sure that they've not got dragged in to an us v them, old firm kind of scenario,
yeah,
around the demise of Rangers and their liquidation and forming as a new club. Celtic have done very, very well to kind of stay out of all of that noise. I think that's why, I was quite surprised to see the response that Celtic were sufficiently on the ball to have raised this with the SFA.
Yep.
Maybe they just take the view, maybe it's a give them enough rope view, that somewhere down the line, something will come to the fore that will expose this. I think the other thing as well is, you know what politics is like, and there are politics. One wonders whether there's a view being taken that says, well, actually, we know what went on, and we're telling you, reading between the lines, we know what, and this is the price that we want to extract for that, and that price may well be Peter Lowell having a place on the SFA Professional Game Board, Peter Lowell having a position on the full Scottish FA Board, and at that point you get to the stage where, because the Scottish FA has been restructured, it makes it incredibly difficult for any decisions to be made by Scottish FA that may be detrimental to Celtic,
yep,
without Peter Lowell knowing about that.
And we've also had the trade trip to China of Doncaster,
yep,
Alex,
yep,
Salmond and Peter Lowell.
Yeah, yeah.
Fairly obvious who, you know, our seat at the top table in that conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
And your point about Celtic sitting back and appreciating that there'll be enough rope,
mm-hmm,
even today with all the Sevco 5088 stuff coming out. I mean, obviously, with all the leaks that have suddenly happened in the last week, you can see there's a shitstorm of information about to come out.
Yeah, yeah.
All being precipitated by the forthcoming AGM,
yeah,
across there. So there's a whole lot of crap happening to do with that. And then Easter time next year, you've got the upper tier tribunal.
Yeah, exactly. And I think all of these things, like over time, people often will look for they'll look for a way in which to, not necessarily undermine an organisation, but really go hell for leather to expose the wrongdoing. And other people sometimes just say, well, actually, these things all manage themselves out over time. So if you take Campbell Ogilvie, for instance, There's no way that Campbell Ogilvie should be in his position. Anybody with any shred of credibility and morality should have resigned a long time ago. But it's obviously they weren't. But basically, at the end of this year, I'm making this assumption given previous announcements and decisions, he will no longer be part of the Scottish FA. And
yep.
Celtic may well have just taken the view, saying, well, actually, that'll be the end of him. And I don't know, who knows, once he's gone, maybe that will be when certain things start to come out. Because it could be that Stuart Regan has said himself, well, actually, in the grand scheme of things at this stage, we cannot afford to have more instability within the Scottish FA at a time when we're restructuring.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the only thing...
Might be trade-offs.
Yeah, I think, and as we've discussed, in most things in life, unless you're the wealthiest man around with absolutely no doubt about it, it doesn't pay. It doesn't reward in the long run to go around continually shouting at people.
Mm.
That's not the best form of negotiation. And sometimes it's better to compromise a little on what your ideal would be in order to get more of what you want in the long run.
I think the other thing for me as well is, I mean, what we're seeing through a whole plethora of bits of information and snippets of conversations and encounters, some of which have been leaked, some of which are coming out in the open. I mean, at the end of the day, you look at it and its most basic level, the Scottish FA and elements of Scottish football are completely incompetent and completely dysfunctional. And the whole thing actually needs completely dismantling and starting again. But the reality is that if you did that dismantling, it would just be, I'm not saying it would be anarchic, but it would just just say to you, well, how do we manage this back together?
Yep.
Because without naming names, you know, the most high profile people who in Stuart Regan's words are heavily conflicted is Campbell Ogilvie. But if you look at some of the other officers at the SFA and the kind of evidence that was given during the tax tribunal, during the Lord Nimmo Smith inquiry, there's just quite clearly corruption and poor management.
Yeah, and for me the biggest thing is the rules have been so. There's been so much discussion about whether the rules have been fairly or unfairly applied by everybody.
Yeah.
The only reason you can have that debate is if the rules are so poorly worded that you can drive a horse and cart through them and
yeah.
don't cover off for every eventuality.
Yeah. I mean, if you put it the other way around and you said, OK, let's go back to Dougie Gate and Hugh Dallas.
Yeah.
If they were still in post and you knew everything then, what you know now, you would actually be walking into an organisation and saying, this organisation has an incompetent chief executive. It has an incompetent and possibly corrupt president. It has a structure which is not fit for purpose to manage its activities. Oh, and by the way, it also has probably six key employees who are also up to their necks in corruption, fraud and favouritism. Now, at that point, if you say you have to get rid of the lot,
yep.
how does that organisation then function?
No, it can't. Yep.
And I think, you know, people maybe have just taken pragmatic views and said, well, some of these things will sort themselves out over time. Some of these things we're going to challenge head on, such as the refereeing and the things that affect us on the field. And some of these things we'll wait for another day.
And I think that's partly what Celtic have done, and I think it's also Celtic are in a, you know, you can't go out with football authorities. They've gone to the SFA, and the SFA had said, no, because technically it filled the rules. If they have gone to UEFA have then batted them back to the SFA. They might have then taken a step back and thought, right, okay, the only thing we can do is play a much longer game on this, get our own man in there and start to change it.
Yeah.
And make sure that this can't happen again, and hope that all the crap that's still to happen over the other side of the city, that we might still get what we want out of this anyway.
Yeah, and I think that's the view they've taken, that some of those individuals are still at the Scottish FA, but they can't actually do anything now in terms of a kind of a backroom decision without Peter Lawwell knowing about it.
Yeah, and despite us mocking those people who refer to Peter Lywell as the unseen Fenian hand running Scottish football.
Yeah.
I think actually we have a lot of influence in Scottish football.
Absolutely. And at one level, I know we as a support and individuals and collectively, there are criticisms to be levelled at Peter Lawwell about the running of Celtic from town to town and certain things, and we've talked about his pay. But if you actually look across Scottish football and actually say to yourself, where are the competent football administrators, as Campbell Ogilvie has been described, where are the competent and forward-thinking people of that ilk? And once you go beyond Peter Lawwell, you're struggling to see anybody.
Yes. So... because we've got some really weird and talk about football.
I know.
So that's the AGM. I would urge anybody who's got the opportunity to get yourselves along. There's free tea and biscuits at the end, if that's the worst thing. And you never know. You might just catch the briefest glimpse of that rare entity called the Dermot Desmond.
Yep. I doubt that very much.
I doubt that too.
He will be on the golf course. Which golf course? I'm not quite sure.
You enjoyed that podcast with the Hull Boy and Harry Brady interpretation and preview of a Celtic AGM. It's not quite as bad as I said in terms of everybody gets a vote and then it goes Dermot Desmond way. I think they do listen, although everybody does get a vote and it does go Dermot Desmond's way. But I think Dermot Desmond's not stupid to completely ignore the support. However, I will be interested to see exactly the mood of the room around a couple of these resolutions, and obviously Dermot won't be there to see what that mood was. He did appear at a couple of the earlier AGMs, the ones that were outdoor, but he doesn't seem to bother, and he'll have a representative there in his place. There'll be a podcast shortly coming up where we discuss Amsterdam and the disaster of Dam Square in terms of the terrible policing strategy, and then there'll be a and also we discuss football, amazing, and then there'll be another podcast which is a review of the AGM. So hopefully you've enjoyed this. Thanks very much for downloading. I'm Harry Brady. Good night. More of a yellow.
Cyclist News.